Welcome to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining me. This is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, wishing you the best. And a very exciting event is going on today and every day for the next week, and that is the Natural Medicine Summit. And at the Natural Medicine Summit, you can listen to 30 presenters, including yours truly, the Natural Nurse. Every single day, there's three or four new ones that are being populated. And what you can do is just find out about this by going to Facebook.com, where we have a link actually posted that you can sign up 100% for free. And there are many, many different presenters there, including Dr. Steven Sinatra, Dr. Michael Murray. Dr. Michael Murray actually is the person who put this event together, and it's a really fantastic thing. He got in touch with me, I would say it was at least 6 months ago when they started planning it. Dr. Mercola is presenting. Mike Adams from Natural News, for those of you who get Natural News, a very, very big presenter. JJ also. There's just so many really, really well-known and famous people, and more important than that, best information, cutting-edge information. If you have to buy a book that you might want to look into in terms of what can you use for one of the best books for natural medicine, especially if you're interested in really the highest level content, I would have to say that that would be Dr. Mike Murray's book, which is the natural medicine textbook that's actually used at all the naturopathic schools. So the textbook of natural medicine really is the preeminent authority, and it is an encyclopedic, well-documented book. And that's where you can actually look up different kinds of illnesses and see the evidence-based, study-oriented, very specific protocol management. And this is the thing that natural doctors actually learn when they go to naturopathic school. So on Facebook.com, The Natural Nurse, you can find a link right on the top. And what I put is that you can just register free at this link. Very, very easy. So you can join Michael Murray, Dr. Steven Sinatra, who's a marvelous cardiologist who's written many, many books in holistic medicine. You may have heard of him. Dr. Mark Hyman, I saw him on PBS yesterday. He's one of the presenters. Ocean Robbins, who is John Robbins' son. J.J. Virgin. So many. There's actually 30 presenters and many, many people that we have had as our guest right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And one of the most wonderful things is very often these kinds of presentations cost quite a bit of money. They have a few $100 registration fee, and of course, if they are in a location, you have to fly there and stay in a hotel. You know, we're talking about thousands of dollars, and here you can get the whole entire thing 100% free. There is a time limit on how long it will be posted. I think it's a week or two, and during that time, you're free to listen in on any of these lectures anytime. And I'm really happy with the fact that here at The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, we know we have over 150,000 of you downloading our shows. That is fantastic. So any one of you can immediately right now go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse, Ellen Kamai, find my Facebook page, and right on the top, I have register free at this link. That's what it says, register free at this link. Summit joining Dr. Michael Murray, Dr. Steven Sinatra, Dr. Joseph Mercola, Dr. Mark Hyman, and many other top-notch physicians and experts and authors in the field of natural medicine. As many of you know, I have been doing this since 1964. That's how long we have actually been very happy to see so many people get well through natural medicine, where they were told in conventional medicine they would never get well, and the only thing they could do is what's called manage their illness. So that's what pharmaceuticals usually will do, and they're pretty good at it. They will manage an illness. So what they do is cover up the symptoms, but they do not cure. As a matter of fact, it's like it is an illegal word, according to the FDA, to say that a natural remedy cures anything. They own that word, cure. Very interesting, since pharmaceuticals really don't tend to cure. They certainly do when it's an emergency situation. They can totally save your life. I love pharmaceutical drugs and surgery when used appropriately. They are just not the appropriate intervention for long-term degenerative illness. In fact, they tend to make it worse over time, and look into the facts. Michael Murray's book has the facts. The books I've written have the facts. You can find those at naturalnurse.com. You can also find the event at naturalnurse.com under calendar. Go down to March 14th, click on that, and you'll be able to register for free as well. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We have a great show for you. And for those of you who are perhaps struggling a little bit financially, and also for those of you who are not and can share what your tricks of the trade are for a really happy, fulfilled life, that's what today's topic is about. The topic is Rich Habits, Rich Life, the four cornerstones of all great pursuits. And we have with us today the author of that book, and his name is Dr. Randall Bell. And the strategic and problem-solving skills of Dr. Bell are well established, and he has consulted on the World Trade Center, Flight 93 crash sites, the BP oil spill, Hurricane Katrina, the nuclear testing on the Bikini Atoll, and his research has taken him to all 50 states and all 7 continents. He is known for his ability to analyze complex situations and present his findings in an interesting, organized, and intelligent way. Dr. Bell's career has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal, People Magazine, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Los Angeles Times, CNN, and every U.S. television network. He's a popular speaker at events around the globe, and he earned his Ph.D. in Human and Organizational Systems from Fielding Graduate University and his MBA from UCLA. And on today's show, we will discuss his new book, which is a must-have for your library if you want to have a rich life. And the name of the book is Rich Habits, Rich Life, the Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Bell.
Well, thank you. Do I call you Ellen or do I call you Dr.?
So Ellen,
well.
Ellen would be fine.
Okay,
Ellen
great.
Would be fine. Most of my listeners know I'm the natural nurse, and you know Ellen is great as a way for us to discuss your interesting topic for today.
Great.
Now, you know, when we began your bio there, we're talking about all kind of disastrous situations. You know?
Indeed we are. As an economist, I do study disasters, and you mentioned some of them. I've worked on hundreds of them. But my book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, was inspired really by the people behind the statistics, behind the numbers and the economics, and really take a good look at how they bounced back and thrived.
So what made you interested, though, originally in even having an expertise in this topic? Let's go back to, you know, you as a younger man.
Well, about 25 or 30 years ago, I was working in the field of real estate and real estate valuation and real estate consulting, and I wanted to do something new, and I actually took the LSAT and got into law school, and I was floating in the pool with my family the day before law school was to start, and I thought, you know, I don't know that the world needs another lawyer, and I'm not really convinced that this is the path I should take. And then I had somewhat of an epiphany in the pool where I thought, you know, what if I take my skill sets of looking at what creates value and I focus on, you know, trying to look at what loses value and loss in value. And my timing happened to be just dumb luck. You know, I live in Southern California, and we had the Northridge earthquake. We had the Malibu firestorms. We had the L.A. riots. These destroyed many properties, and that got me, you know, very involved with, you know, a very interesting new career with damaged real estate, which has taken me all over the world, like you mentioned, the World Trade Center. And then that evolved into really sitting down for many times for hours talking to the people behind the statistics, and that evolved into really looking at what particular behaviors allow people to bounce back and thrive after these disasters. So it was kind of an evolution of events that kind of took me to where I am today.
Well, it's an interesting area of expertise. And you worked on, you know, many different cases, and then I guess you found patterns, which you talk about in your book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, the four cornerstones of all great pursuits. Let's backtrack a little and tell our listeners, what do you mean by great pursuits?
Well, I let the reader of the book define what that means to them. I try to stay very clear of being presumptuous and saying, well, this is what success is, because what looks like success to me might look like something else to you or to a listener. And for example, of course, money pops up with the word success, you know, obviously and quite often. But for, I know I have a good friend, and his idea of success is beating cancer. I have my 14-year-old son, his idea of success is winning tonight's volleyball game or learning his guitar better. So we all look at success differently, but what I look at in the book in a very kind of scientific way is, what is the foundation that has to be laid by anybody, no matter how we define our own success?
So it's something that really switches. It's not like, okay, you make this much money and then you're a billionaire and then you're successful. There are many different ways to measure what's a feeling of success.
You're absolutely right, Ellen. I happen to have clients, well, I have many clients that are very, very wealthy, and I have even some clients that are billionaires. And I tell people that are really, you know, anxious to earn a lot of money that I hope they do so quickly so they can get out of their system once they realize just how unsatisfying it really is, that really happiness comes from other things. We have to, in my research, we actually, in writing this book, I took 25 years to write it. It was not a rush job. And in part of the process of writing the book, we surveyed over 5,000 people in the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Australia, and we correlated various daily habits with various measures of success. And one of the things that came out of the study I think you'd find really interesting, Ellen, is that money does correlate to happiness, but only to a point. That statistical correlation only exists for people that are struggling to pay their basic bills. But from the income bracket of $25,000 to $50,000 a year and up, you are statistically just as likely to be happy in that income bracket or up as a billionaire. In other words, if you have enough money to pay basic bills, there is absolutely no correlation to happiness beyond that.
Right, but below that, you know, I would say that's kind of makes people struggle, just like they used to talk about years ago, in terms of meeting basic needs.
You're absolutely right. I volunteer at a homeless shelter near where I live in Laguna Beach, California, and I meet a lot of people that, you know, used to have, you know, good lives, and they made some mistakes in talking about habits. They got into some bad habits oftentimes. And for them, money does very much correlate to happiness. They're very anxious, at least in the group that I teach, they're very anxious to put their lives back together and get jobs, maintain those jobs. So we talk about the skill sets of doing that and saving money and you know, habits like showing up to work 5 minutes early, showing, you know, leaving maybe 5 minutes late while you're at work, adding value to your boss's business so that your boss will, you know, see the value in your work and give you more hours and raises and rebuild your life. So there's no question. Whoever says money doesn't matter didn't sleep under a bridge. And I've met lots of people that have slept under bridges in all kinds of places. And in that category, there's no question money does correlate with happiness.
And I would share this. When I was a lot younger, I actually grew up in a pretty privileged environment, although I didn't see it that way when I was young. I actually felt that materialism and a feeling of deep spiritual self-worth were diametrically opposed.
Yeah,
believe it or not. When I was growing up, being surrounded by so many things, and it seemed like the focus, let's say it was a religious holiday, what it seemed like we were supposed to do about that is not necessarily have a spiritual connection, but get 5 outfits with matching shoes. And to me, as a child, that was a complete turnoff.
Interesting comment. Yeah, I know a lot of people who are very wealthy who are also very, very spiritual and put a lot of emphasis in their lives in the meditation and prayer and kindness and looking for opportunities to be of service to others. And I see other people, rich and poor, that are, frankly, they're just pigs. It's all about consumption and greed. And, you know, that's sad. I hope those people will grow out of that phase. But I don't see, after you take care of basic needs, I don't know that there is a statistical correlation between money and spirituality. I think they're both important. One of the problems I see in the world today is spiritual poverty, where people, you know, neglect those things of real authentic worth, and that's obviously a big problem that I'm trying to address head-on with this book. My son says something kind of funny. He says, "Dad, you know, that you, when someone reads this book, it's pretty deep. It really hits some nerves, and yet you, in the title, you have the word rich twice." But I guess what I'm trying to do is capture the attention of people in spiritual poverty and kind of gently guide them towards a more balanced lifestyle.
Well, you do talk about the subtitle of the book, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. So let's talk about, you know, some of those cornerstones. What is cornerstone number one?
Cornerstone number one, I'll just say them all, but I'll go back to one. There are four little words, me, we, do, be. And the me cornerstone, the first cornerstone, is our mindset. It's basically what we think intellectually, what we believe philosophically, and what we feel spiritually.
So it doesn't have a mnemonic. I'm looking at it, me, we, do, be. They don't stand for anything in particular, other than those are where you see the cornerstones. So where would we start out with the me?
Well, me cornerstone habits are things like reading, meditation, prayer, nature walks, anything that builds our mindset and our attitude and builds our, you know, who we really are exists upstairs in our minds, in our attitudes. And I found that avid readers, for example, dominate in all categories of success, in both wealth and income, but also happiness and also education. So avid reading statistically correlates with a lot of success. The other thing that I learned was that those who meditate are 92% more likely to have an advanced college degree. So there's a correlation between turning off what I call the digital drugs and just being reflective. Einstein was a master of that. Einstein, of course, was a great thinker, but he didn't come to his great revelations, you know, with being distracted. He went to his apartment and he would turn off the phone and any communication and sit and think quietly, not just for an hour or two or a day or two, but more like a week or two at a time. So reflective thinking is really critically important.
And what kind of tools do you share with individuals who find that difficult? I've been a meditator since the 1970s, and, you know, I actually read an article, believe it or not, in Newsday magazine, and it was called God and the Brain.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in 2008. It was the cover story. And they did a fascinating analysis where they looked at different paths, you know, like you could talk about prayer, even if it's religious prayer. In fact, they used, I believe, Catholic nuns. They used Tibetan Buddhists. So people who use different ways to get to that state of inner peace. And then they actually did a brain analysis, and what they found is that the part of the brain that got turned off through any of these paths was exactly the same. And it was the part of the brain that establishes for us the separation between self and everything else. which of course is important to have in place. Like if you're driving a car, you don't want to be union with everything. But in times of spirituality, you do. And everyone describes that feeling of inner peace, of this feeling of universal integration. So I found that article so interesting because I could learn then to isolate that part of my brain, just like you learn how to ride a bicycle, and sort of instantly turn it off. You can use the techniques or you can just turn it off and feel that feeling of inner peace. So that was really instructive to me in terms of the scientific aspects of using these paths.
I love your comments, and what I'm trying to do is wake people up through the book to exactly that concept of really listening to yourself. I think there's great answers inside of us if we'll simply turn off the distractions and really listen. And yet it's difficult for a lot of people to start meditating because, frankly, they crave the distractions. I know one lady who has a really, you know, she's wealthy, but she has, frankly, a chaotic, miserable life. Her husband was involved in fraud and all kinds of horrible things, and she craved distraction, and a lot of people do. And so what my recommendation is just start slow and maybe just for a minute or two with the hopes that that kind of catches root and grows. But a lot of people have a difficult time really listening to their own thoughts because they don't really like what's there. They like the distraction.
Yeah. So what is there a technique you talk about in Rich Habits, Rich Life, which a good intro into finding that inner peace? Because, you know, sometimes if you say, oh, you got to sit quiet for half an hour, that is much too stressful for some individuals.
Yeah, good point. I think that, I try and be very respectful of the fact that, as you say, some people, have habits of prayer and religious worship, and those are terrific. Some people are not religious, and they more are in tune with nature walks. Whatever works for you, I would support and I would encourage. And so maybe it's just taking a walk along the beach or along the river or around the lake for 15 minutes and just, you know, admiring the beauty of that. But something, I'm a big believer in something small. There's something I call the January 4th effect, which is the day that most New Year's resolutions are abandoned. That the way to combat the January 4th effect and really make these habits like meditation or prayer or nature walks a really important part of life is to just really start small. In fact, with one of the homeless, my homeless friends, he was really in a mess, and we started with one push-up a day. That was his only commitment, and it grew into getting a job and reconnect with his family. So I'm a big believer in just starting small, but make it really foolproof. Make it flat out, frankly, idiot-proof, but start small, but just let it naturally grow, and it will.
Yeah, that is interesting. It reminds me of one time my husband, who does find it challenging to turn off, built me a beautiful meditation garden in the back, and then he said, okay, now I'm going to sit in it 1 second. I said, good, even 1 second is a good idea. So you have really tips in your book about how to get started in Rich Habits, Rich Life. Now, why is it that when faced with some kind of traumatic event, some people actually are able to survive and thrive and others don't seem to be able to break that cycle?
That's a great question, Ellen, because I've noticed with talking to these people for decades that there's what in sociology, of course, we call a baseline. That's just kind of your average condition. And then along comes a crisis, and it could be one of the big ones that hits the headlines. Most of my cases, frankly, most people have never heard of, but of course the big ones people have. But whatever that crisis is, some people dive. They never recover. They never get back to the baseline. And frankly, they're defeated. And I'm not just judgmental. I've never been through what they've been through, but that's a sad reality. And yet some people work their way back and they survive. They get back to that baseline. And yet others thrive. They actually bounce back bigger and better than they were before. And they actually exceed that best baseline and they thrive. And what I found with that mindset is those people are particularly adaptive. They're open to new ways of thinking with the me cornerstone. With the we cornerstone, they're open to new relationships. however that looks in their condition. They're open to, with the do cornerstone, they're open to new levels of productivity, and they're also open to the be cornerstone of a new future and looking at the future in a new way. And the other thing about thrivers I've noticed is they're pragmatic. They let go of the things that we can't control. We can't control what happened in the past. We can't control the weather. There's so many things we can't control. So we've got to look at what we really authentically do control. And what we control are things like what time we get up, what foods we put in our mouths. You know that as a holistic expert. We control what attitudes we're going to have, what we're going to read. In other words, those rich habits are what we really control. So really conscientiously focusing on rich habits and instilling them gradually into our lives really takes us to a whole new level of peak performance.
Well, that's a wonderful thought. And with that, we're going to take a little break right here on The Natural Nurse. And Dr. Z, I invite you to go to Facebook, The Natural Nurse, sign up for the webinar, which has started today, the Natural Healthcare Summit. And we're going to return with our guest today, Dr. Randall Bell, and we're talking about his book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, how you can bring those into your reality. We'll be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
On this edition of The Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the folklore, history, chemistry, and medicinal applications of the common kitchen herb, thyme.
The common culinary spice known botanically as Thymus vulgaris is only one member of a large genera which includes over 400 species and even more varieties. The Thymus genera is originally native to the Mediterranean region and is a perennial plant which grows wild in usually dry, sandy soil, green heaths, and grasslands. Thyme is a prolific, fragrant, creeping ground cover and often displays an attractive spray of flowering branchlets spanning the spectrum from white to violet.
There is considerable debate amongst historians as to the origin of the name thyme. Some believe it to be from the Greek thymen, meaning to fumigate or to burn a sacrifice, because it was used as a sweet-smelling incense and also to keep pests and venomous creatures away from the Greek home. Others believe it came from the Greek thumos, meaning courage or energy, perhaps because it has a reputation of being used by Greek warriors for courage and was bathed in and used as a beverage for invigoration. The Egyptians used an herb called tham, which we believe is Thymus vulgaris, to mummify their dead. The principal chemical constituents of thyme are the volatile oils consisting of phenol, thymol, and carvacrol. A 1977 article in the scientific journal Chemical Abstracts revealed that thymol's antimicrobial activity is 18 times more powerful than phenol. Phenol is a major antiseptic used in commercial germicidal cleaners like Lysol. Thymol is one of the most potent antimicrobial substances known and far surpasses even the strongest antibiotics. It has been illustrated in the Journal of Chemistry and in the Merck Index of Drugs and Chemicals to destroy parasites, worms, fungi, bacteria, mosquito larvae, and many viruses.
The pharmaceutical and cosmetic industry is privy to the important medicinal effects of oil of Thymus vulgaris. It is ubiquitously found in gargles, cough drops, vapor rubs, and many mouthwashes. Oil of thyme is to be used, albeit very sparingly because of its potency, as a gargle or mouthwash for sore throats and inflamed gums. Because the volatile oil is expelled via the lungs and kidneys, naturopathic physicians use it for upper respiratory infections and urinary tract infections. If you're in the midst of a cold and are lying in bed with too much thyme on your hands, try making a thyme tea made with just a few teaspoons of thyme to a cup of boiling water. It's an excellent diaphoretic because it causes the body to perspire profusely. Thyme also possesses an excellent carminative and antispasmodic effect, helping in poor digestion, flatulence, and intestinal gripe.
So, listeners, if you're feeling ill, thyme heals all wounds. Remember to reach for that thyme in a bottle the next time you open up the Natural Medicine Chest.
back. Two more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thank you so much for joining us. And we love to see you in person. Go to naturalnurse.com, click on calendar, and see all of the up-and-coming events where you can actually join myself and Dr. Eugene Zamperone, with the hosts of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And you can join us in person in Jamaica, the island of Jamaica. We're actually running our yearly intervention where we go there and live with indigenous healers in basically the jungle. It's a beautiful area there on the north coast of Jamaica. And we actually get to live the life of indigenous people for a week. Really refreshing and life-changing. We do that every year, and you can get college credits for attending that course. And then we have two up-and-coming presentations in Chinatown, New York City. The first one's going to be April 10th. That always sells out. So if you think you'd like to come, go online and register now. And then we also have various herb walks where we go outside, gather wild medicinal plants, and make them into food and medicine. You go home with your own medicine. And we have so many online classes now. If you're listening in from Illinois or Dallas, Texas, or wherever you are, I know we have 150,000 listeners all over the country. You can join us for credit, actually, CE credit, for nurses, massage therapists, acupuncturists, midwives, and you get these credits by taking our online classes. So we have lots of those going on as well. Just go to naturalnurse.com and click on schedule. Today we have as our guest Randall Bell, who has a very impressive resume, and he has been working for many years with various people who have struggling issues. And he has definitely been involved in some that you've heard about, such as the World Trade Center, Flight 93 crash sites, the BP oil spill, and many other events. And he has been profiled in the Wall Street Journal, People Magazine, the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, and other top venues. And then, of course, he is our guest today on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Bell.
Oh, Ellen, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Now, you've been talking about what people can find out in your book, Rich Habits, Rich Life. And you decided to bring this book out because while you helped a lot of people on a one-to-one level, I guess you thought you could reach so many more if they could get a hold of this book and use it as a cornerstone of their life.
Well, that's my hope. Honestly, the motivating guiding light, if you will, for writing the book was my own kids. I mean, what parent doesn't want to have give their very best that they have to their own children? And having had this privilege, and it really has been a privilege that I've been very grateful for, to go to all these various places around the world and see all these things, it was really kind of a journal of that experience for my kids. And then anybody else, of course, is welcome to read it as well. But that was really the engine behind the motivation to spend 25 years writing this work.
And throughout the book, you have wonderful, I guess, habits, you call them, like habit number 23, enjoy dinner as a family. How many people do that anymore?
I don't know how many people do, but those who do are very fortunate, because those who have that habit of really going to that effort of having dinner together as a family are 41% more likely to be happy and 43% more likely to earn over $100,000 a year. So there's a strong correlation between, you know, making that effort. I know as a parent myself, my wife and I have a hard time, and just last night we went to a lot of work to, create a big dinner for my wife's niece and for my son, and getting the whole family together, but it was worth it because it brings everyone together around the table to talk. We have a ritual of talking about what we call flowers and tumbleweeds. What was the best thing of the day? Our flowers and our tumbleweeds. What was the disappointment of the day? And those are memories that are just terrific to have.
Now, we talked about me as the first cornerstone. And let's move on to the we cornerstone. What is that about?
Well, we is our connection with other people. It's our social capital. It's our relationships. And we develop those through any number of ways, just maybe smiling more, maybe listening a little more carefully to what someone else is saying, sending thank you cards. But those things that we do to create friendships and relationships with other people.
And looking at that, when you're dealing with people who might have a life that isn't that fulfilling, like you said, you work a lot with homeless people. Some of them have very good friendships as well. So in what way could they, you know, change that to have a richer life?
Well, with the homeless, and frankly, a lot of people that aren't homeless that have, you know, what at least on the outside looks like a normal life, a lot of people are drawn to, you know, drama and toxicity. And in this book, I can tell you that my clients in general are not at all interested in a candy-coated theory. They need real results. They have serious issues going on. And so I take a look at some unpleasant topics of dealing with toxic people, sociopaths, narcissists, borderline personality disorders, and essentially what I have come to as a conclusion is that we've got to be able to identify in our circle of influence around us who's healthy and who's not so healthy, and really gravitate conscientiously towards the healthy people, because it's very easy to be drawn into drama. It's very easy to be drawn into toxicity, and so with the homeless, I tell them, look, you know, unfortunately, a lot of them have alienated, you know, good friendships and family relationships because of whatever problems that they have. Oftentimes, it's prescription drug addictions or alcohol is what I see most often. But whatever it is, we've got to get those good relationships back, and that means leaving behind toxic relationships and those who helped you on your pathward downward. We've got to sever those relationships.
Now, what if those relationships are with, let's say, your adult children who are, you know, having a struggle in life? How do you sever that, even though it might be best for you?
Well, I think when we have a child who's, you know, kind of gone off course, it's all about tough love, and it's very, very difficult. But we've got to, of course, parents, I believe, this is my own value system, I believe that we owe our children unconditional love. But we don't owe our children any kind of financial enablement for bad choices. And, you know, I've had an instance in my own family. It's personal, but I'll share that, you know, I have a child who was, frankly, doing things that were just not appropriate, and I had to cut off his college fund. It hurt to do it, and he had to get a job, and he had to quit college. But as long as he behaved in a certain way, I just wasn't going to support it. And as a dad, that was very, very difficult to do. I can tell you today, we have a terrific relationship, and I'm flying up to see him, in fact, just next week. And but it's those decisions to say, hey, I love you. That's unconditional, but I'm not going to support you financially or any other way in these bad choices.
Right, and you know, that is like a step, because then to see, let's say, somebody that you love catapulting down a downward course, which you could foresee through the choices that they made, is certainly difficult. I like what you talk about in the Stanford Marshmallow Study in terms of deferred gratification, because I think that's something that successful people do share. And anyone who's, you know, gone for any kind of higher education knows that, because you have to, let's say, work on schoolwork, which means putting time into that, so you can't be making money at a job. And also, you can't always go out and have fun when you want. I mean, there's a sense of deferred gratification so that more happens in your life later on.
Well, you're exactly right, Ellen. And to quickly review that study so everybody's on board with what it was a study up in Stanford where a professor gave marshmallows to little kids and said, well, if you wait 15 minutes, I'm going to go to my car, and if you wait until I get back before you eat it, you'll get another marshmallow. And then they would watch, of course, the child behind a two-way mirror, and about a third of the children just, you know, as soon as the professor was out of sight, they popped that marshmallow down their mouths, instant gratification. And then about a third gave it a good shot. They waited a while, but they yielded, you know, to that temptation. And then about a third waited, you know, the 15 minutes and doubled up on their marshmallow glory. So basically what that teaches, that's human nature. And then it was a longitudinal study. They followed those children through life, and they found, of course, that those who needed instant gratification were also those who had a penchant for getting into drugs and a bunch of addictive behaviors, which were toxic. And those who were who waited were the ones that graduated from college and had, you know, stellar lives. And it's so true that, as you just said, as I wrote this book, I had a lot of friends going down to the beach and having a lot of instant gratification, which frankly I missed. But, you know, I kept working, you know, year after year on something that now I'm enjoying, you know, a terrific big reward for. But that was a choice that I made, and sometimes I haven't made quite that good of a choice, but that's an important part of understanding that aspect of human behavior.
It is. And, boy, in terms of writing a book in particular, I will comment on that because I have written 11 books. And, yes, people always say, I'm going to write a book. And I ask them, how are you going to write it? And then they have this long philosophical discussion. I said, but that's not going to get it written. You have to actually put in your schedule the times that you will be working on this book, and that's what you do in those times. Because otherwise, it's never time to write the book.
You're right, and I admire your accomplishment. 11 books, that's some heavyweight effort. And so you know.
And a lot of deferred gratification, as you said.
A lot of deferred gratification. But in the process, you're helping a lot of people, and that helper's high, you can't beat that with any counterfeit highs that the world offers. So I applaud you for that.
Now, you have a lot of discussion in the book, especially in Chapter 5, about spirituality and connecting with a higher power, which I really not only believe in, that is the main tenet of my life. But recently I had a conversation with someone, you know, who's an atheist.
Mm-hmm.
And what about that?
Well, I feel that I don't have the faith that's required to be an atheist. I talk in the chapter somewhat scientifically about the fact that to prove atheism scientifically, if we adopt all the scientific rules, the second law of thermodynamics really destroys the concept of atheism, and you cannot say conclusively that there is no creator. There is no intelligent design until you go throughout the entire universe and validate that he or she or that creator doesn't exist anywhere, and that's of course impossible. So it takes an enormous amount of faith to adopt atheism. I talk about theism. Neil Armstrong, the first man to walk on the moon, was a theist. He just thought that nature was evidence enough of a supreme creator. But as far as organized religion, he rejected that. And then, of course, theists have organized religion. So there's a spectrum of beliefs. I lay them all out, and I point out why I personally don't have the faith to be an atheist. But it's a wonderful journey to try and get answers and to try and get in tune with spiritual things that are of substance, of importance. And I think it's important that everybody does. As I say all the time, spiritual poverty is, in my mind, worse than financial poverty because, as you say, spirituality is really the essence of what life's all about, not money and greed and accumulation of stuff.
And you do find that people who have, let's say, struggling with various kinds of alcoholism and drug problems, they'll often find that if they are able to elevate their spiritual life, that is a big factor in their recovery.
Absolutely. I happen to have a brother and also one of my very best friends attends 12-step programs on literally a daily basis. And they've both told me the same thing, and I've seen it with my work with the homeless as well, that it's really, I don't want to say impossible, but that's a pretty strong stand, but it's very difficult to really get sober and stay sober without a faith in a higher power, whatever you choose to call that. And it's just, that's just been borne out decade after decade with looking at addictions and what successful people do in terms of moving beyond their addictions and leading a rich and fulfilling life, is just essential.
So true. Well, we're going to take another little break right here because we love to give our station, which is Gary Null's station, Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, and they host our show every week, The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we're on live right now with our guests, and that's Tuesdays, 10 to 11 a.m. But what's so wonderful is you can listen to any show right here on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, any time of day or night because the archives are fantastic. So we're going to give a chance right now to listen about more shows that you can get right here on Progressive Radio Network. We'll be right back with more.
We are PRN. 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 Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned. Tuned.
My name is David Crowe, and I want you to listen to my new show on PRN.FM called The Infectious Myth. Really, the only thing infectious about the show will be the questions that start cascading when the myths about infectious disease come tumbling down. There is no infectious paradigm that, when examined closely with scientific evidence, does not have serious holes. SARS, AIDS, polio, mad cow. We will cover all of these and even stray into other areas of questionable science on occasion. I hope you will listen and even call in. Challenge me if you like. Interesting discussions will result. If you don't catch my show live every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, listen to the podcast. And if you use iTunes, do me a favor and rate the show there. That's The Infectious Myth, Tuesday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, every week.
This is Guy McPherson. Join me and Mike Sliva with Nature Bats Last Radio on PRN.FM. Catch us Tuesday evening at 8 p.m. on the East Coast. You can rate the show on iTunes, and if you don't catch us live, you can catch us 24/7 in the PRN archives. That's 8 p.m. Eastern Time with Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM.
Thank you for listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome back to more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And we are having a very interesting conversation today with Dr. Randall Bell. And he has written a book called Rich Habits, Rich Life, The Four Cornerstones of All Great Pursuits. And right on the front, he has a really nice insignia about what those four cornerstones are: me, we, and the next one, the all-important, do. Because it's one thing, Dr. Bell, is it not to be philosophical and spiritual, but it's a completely other step to actually have an action plan and carry it out.
You're absolutely right, Ellen. I mean, my dad used to say, to be successful, you've got to do what successful people do. And the emphasis was on the word do and doing my chores and that kind of thing. And economics, we call productivity land, labor, and capital. But I think in everyday conversations, it's better to say taking care. We've got to take care of our health, as you know so well. You've got to take care of your money. You've got to take care of your home and your workspace. And in business, we got to take care of our products and services. So these are our to-do lists, and we've just got to take care of them. There's no way around it.
And what kind of tips do you have for actually making plans to do that?
Well, in doing our survey, one of the things that really popped out at all of us in my research team here is that it starts in the morning with a mindset. It's in terms of getting up early and getting your mind going early and taking, you know, my personal habit is to get up early and before everyone else and meditate, pray, read something inspirational, put myself in that mindset right up front. But getting to do, making your bed in the morning gives you a 207% better chance of becoming a millionaire. And maybe money is your thing and maybe it's not, but the fact is that making your bed puts your mind into a productive mindset, and that's something that carries out throughout the day with starting with that one rich habit of just making your bed.
So it's basically following through with taking care of sort of what could be considered the minutiae. I'm looking at page 133 in your book, Rich Habits, Rich Life, and you have these really interesting boxes throughout the book, and this is called Rich Habit Number 30. So you actually have worst habits listed, and eating poorly is number one. Procrastination, that's a big one, and lack of exercise.
Yeah, absolutely. Exercise is a big one, and what I found there is it doesn't matter. You know, my idea of exercise is there's a 5-mile loop around where I live, and I walk this 5 miles, and it takes me an hour, hour and a half to walk and run that loop.
That's a pretty fast walk for 5 miles.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I try and put some running in there too. But my point is that you don't have to do that to exercise. Even just 15 minutes, and who doesn't have 15 minutes of really hard exercise or even light exercise? But getting out there and moving is so essential. And it's so sad to see people that have bodies of failure where they're not eating poorly and not taking care of some you know, basic exercise requirements.
And you also have an interesting one, not being on time.
Yeah, I mean, I think being punctual is essential. I mean, it shows respect to the people we're meeting, and when we're late, it's really a sign of selfishness. Of course, we all get tied up with accidents or traffic or whatever from time to time. But as a general rule, I try to be punctual. My wife calls it freak mode in terms of, you know, being on time or being early. But I just think it's important to show respect to the people we're meeting, to show up on time, and things go better when we do.
But you actually have specific ratings in this as well. Where did these numbers come from, such as eating poorly, 272?
Well, the numbers are an index to show the relative proportion to the numbers above and below them. And it came from the survey of the 5,000 people from around the English-speaking world, so we can see how various habits stack up against others and really kind of stimulate a discussion on what we do with our time and what habits we adopt and which bad habits we hopefully shun.
Well, what would be some of those that people try to shun? I mean, sometimes it's a habit and sometimes it's just ingrained in their personality.
It can be, and I really believe strongly in a ripple effect where we don't try and overhaul our lives or our businesses in 15 minutes, and they offer, you know, the world offers a lot of counterfeits where you know you buy a book or you take a, you know, program or whatever, and it promises miraculous results instantly. That's of course nonsense, and I've been to seminars myself where, you know, during the event I feel like, you know, Hercules, I can take on and do anything, but by the time I get onto the parking lot and put my key into the door, I'm back to just being a lazy slob. So I'm really into authentic results and what really works. And what really works is a slow, steady paced effort, not some miraculous candy coated theory or unicorns or fairy dust, but something that really works is just that more sensible, pragmatic, day to day paced effort, which over time builds up and builds up to something of significance. That's my philosophy, and that's really based on seeing what really works in the aftermath of these disasters. It's not people that get all excited and burn out quickly. It's those who just calmly, collectively work at it day by day.
Yeah, and have a plan, an action plan. And something that you have written in the B habits, which is the last cornerstone, is have written goals. I saw a very interesting study, a longitudinal study that lasted 20 years, on, I think it was Harvard graduates, those who wrote their goals versus those who did not physically write them, and the difference in goal attainment.
I'm so glad you said that, because you're right on point, because those, I say that a goal not written is merely a wish. When you write it down, it's a commitment. Something powerful happens when you actually commit it to writing. It becomes more tangible, and I think you have a much greater chance of success when you write that goal down, and also share it with others. Not everyone. You may not want to share with your boss that your goal is to become the boss or whatever, but share it with a supportive group of close friends or family. That's important too.
So what I started doing when I read that study, and I read it back in the 1970s, I believe, I write down once a year, and Dr. Zamperone and I, my partner on this show, we write down once a year our business goals for the year, and then I have a weekly goal that I do on Sunday on what action steps, mini action steps, call this person, you know, what mini action steps am I going to do this week that are going to, you know, end with that big goal at the end of the year, or sometimes we have a five-year plan even.
Yeah, you're exactly right. The basic process of legitimate goal setting is to first assess where you're weak. Don't just jump into a goal. Really carefully select that goal in the first place. And as you say, break it down into manageable action tasks and prioritize it. What I do was, in my day-to-day planning, I'll circle everything that requires a trip in the car so I can batch those things together more efficiently rather than running in and out and in and out. And take them in manageable steps. And also, another part of goal setting a lot of people ignore is when you reach a milestone, have a little celebration, you know, however you want to define that. But celebrate your success along the way. And, of course, when you reach that big final goal, you know, have a real celebration. So those are the key points of really successful goal setting.
Well, thank you so much for being our guest today. The time has gone very quickly. I want to tell our listeners that they can find Rich Habits, Rich Life at a great website called richhabits.com. Do you have any other parting words for us, Dr. Randall Bell?
Well, Ellen, I think you've been just a terrific host and asked some great questions, and I think we're all in this together. My rich habit, I quit, but you'll be happy to know my rich habit was, my homeless friend, his rich habit was to quit, do one push-up a day. Mine was to quit drinking diet sodas, which was a horrible habit. And in just doing that one habit, I've already lost about 25 pounds. So it's up to everyone to pick a rich habit that works for them, and just we all keep working together to make life better for everyone.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for joining us once again for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Check out our website at naturalnurse.com. You can go to books to find our books. You can go to products to find various natural supplements. And you can go to calendar to find out all the online and on-ground classes that Dr. Zamperone and I teach. Until next week, this is Ellen Kamai, The Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.